It's a complicated medium. And so the way your vertically polarized wave comes off your antenna and gives you some kind of angle in the space where the angle is maximum, where the RF energy is maximum, that's called the pseudo-Brewster angle, I am guessing. So I wonder if that word, pseudo, that you pronounced, possibly is pseudo, P-S-E-U-D-O or something like that. It's a kind of a mathematical term. Back to you, Mel. K-Q-L-I-W.
I think it's got several pronunciations, Dick, because I think the Spanish pronunciation is pseudo. American pronunciation is, I mean, pseudo. And I think there's another pronunciation of it that's used in the UK that I heard. But it's basically, I think, referred to as the PBA, the pseudo-Brewster angle. And it varies with the frequency. I remember reading it that, in other words, at one frequency, if you take the dielectric constant of the soil, at that frequency, it's different than if, for instance, you went from 40 meters, 7 megahertz, to 20 meters, that the dielectric constant of the soil will still be the same, but what happens is the PBA, it changes. Am I correct on this? You know, this is so much stuff I have back of my head, I mean. You know, I don't work with this, but I believe that for the working out the what is known as the vertical reflection coefficient for a vertical. Am I correct on some of this, Dick? Over.
You would have to be low, Mel. In other words, the dielectric constant of the soil, the ratio of that capacitive reactance to the resistance would have to be frequency sensitive. And so therefore the Brewster angle or the reflection characteristics for a vertically polarized wave striking soil would have to be frequency sensitive. Now, is it very frequency sensitive or a small amount of frequency sensitive for your particular soil? There, I don't know. But I think it would have to be frequency sensitive. I'm with you on that one. But an awful lot of this jazz becomes a hell of a lot simpler once a person decides to put up a half wave dipole vertically polarized, as opposed to going through all of that effort of zillions of ground plane radials because you want the vertical radiated to be quarter wave or 5/8 wave. Half wave has got an awful lot going for it. I'm still amazed that we've given so little emphasis in all of our literature on vertically polarized antennas. One of the very few thoroughly vertically polarized half wave antennas in operation on planet Earth in the United States seems to be the one on Dover Street in front of your house, Mel. Every time you describe it to somebody on the air, but they say, gee, I've never heard of that. What are you talking about? And, boy, you sound like you're running 2 gallons, and you tell me you're only running 100 watts. What's going on there? I bet you from your experience, because you're much more of an HF operator than I am, I'll bet you get a fair amount of skepticism when you describe that green piece of wire that's hanging in the evergreen tree in front of your house. Back to you on that one, Mel. Give it enough drop. K-Q-L-I-W.
Yeah, I had it today. I had visitors today from Pennsylvania and a couple other hands. They were visiting. Actually, it's a group we got together today. These were people that I met when I was in Fort Jackson, South Carolina with Uncle Sam back in the 60s. And so we had a little get-together, and one of the guys, very funny, he says, you caused all my trouble in life. I says, how did I do that? He says, you forced me to learn CW, and in kind of that, I haven't stopped buying all this equipment and things, so he's quite a ham. But when I got a hold of him originally, when I first met him, you know, they gave him an aptitude test when he entered the Army. And they said, well, you're going to make a CW operator out of you. And I was his instructor. He never knew nothing about it. From that into ham radio eventually, radio communications in the military. And so he holds me responsible for him purchasing lots of ham equipment. But I was showing them the antennas today, especially the tree mounted and all, and they were flabbergasted. They said, wow, how did you get that up there? So it does work out quite well. But as you said, you know, with all this vertical, reflection coefficients and all, the math behind all this PBA, this Brewster angle stuff, there's a lot of very heavy math behind it. And like you say, all you have to do is put up, if you want to put a vertical up or something of that sort, make it a dipole, a vertical dipole. No reason why you can't. In fact, by tilting it and fooling around with that angle at the bottom, you'd be amazed what you can accomplish, Dick. I think I'm on the borderline of that fractal antenna, over.
Sounds right, Mel. Let me drop long enough. That friend of yours, who is now a friend, who claims that you've really changed his life, that was a life-defining moment when he ran into you and you taught him Morse code in the Army. Gee, just look the way you changed the rest of his life. And because it put him into a particular environment, he met a particular girl, married the particular girl, had particular children. Look at all the things you've changed. If somebody went back in history and made just that minor difference, entirely different life would have been lived. Would have been better or worse, who knows? And you can't go back in time. We can talk about time shifts, and it makes nice science fiction. I'm kind of skeptical. Whenever you read any of the better written articles on what is time, you suddenly discover it's an awful difficult thing to define. It's rather subjective. You may think you've got a timepiece that can read time to the nearest 10 digits, 10 decimal places. That's a certain way of measuring time under certain conditions. But what really is it? And can you make it flow faster or slower? And can you ever make it go backwards? Well, when it comes to metamaterial study, there's been quite a few articles recently published in Antennas and Propagation magazine and Microwave Theory and Technique, the journals of Microwave Theory and Techniques and the Antennas and Propagation Society. They've discovered ways of making artificial dielectric materials that have negative refractive index. And oh boy, you want to see the latest issue, for instance, the issue that just came out of Antennas and Propagation Journal, has a whole bunch of technicolor pictures trying to show you what happens with these synthesized materials and the crazy reflection angles when you can get negative reflection coefficients. They call them left-handed materials versus right-handed materials. When you make the permittivity and permeability both go negative, it becomes a so-called left-handed material. You want to speak about chirality. Oh, boy, you can have a grand old time with this jazz if you want to. And I think it's now coming out of what probably used to be classified information with reference to stealth techniques for making a boat or aircraft or any other kind of a vehicle disappear on a radar screen. That's where I think some of this is coming from. But we're off subject. Maybe you ought to consider going to your mailbag, Mel, or continue on the subject you're on. The choice is yours. KQKEY, KQRIW. Leave some delay.
Okay, let me just clarify one thing about going in the Army in those days and about the aptitude test. You could take an aptitude test and entering the Army, they gave everybody the test and they decided what you're going to be in the Army. And you could have been one of these big, tough guys that work up there and putting up iron in the steel, the framing, and wind up a cook, and literally. And this guy, he says, I didn't even know what CW is. But they gave you a stupid test to determine if you had any aptitude for copying CW. And for some reason, they found that he had a knack for CW. And so I had him. He didn't want to be in that class. I think he used to give me looks if stairs could kill, I wouldn't be here anymore. He would stare at me with those eyes. So then when he got into it, he became, now I said, so? I said, I bet you never hook the key up. He says, what, are you kidding me? He says, I never operate phone. I'm a CW operator. I says, what happened? He says, well, I got into this stuff for some reason. I never got it out of my blood. He says, I love it so much. So there you are. That was the thinking of the time. I don't know what they do today, but that was what transpired back in those days. All right, now, let's see. What else was I going to mention? Let me let it drop.
Yeah, I got a question for you, Mel. To me, the most obvious question is how in the world do you test a man for his aptitude for Morse code reception if he had never heard of Morse code and had never practiced it? How in the world do you test that aptitude? Now back to you, Mel.
Now, describe the test.
Exactly.
They tap over the loudspeaker you'd hear. They say, now you're going to be tested on a... to see if they didn't call it Morse code. They just said you're going to take the next step on the test. And they gave you four boxes, number one, two, three, four, and each one had a little four boxes next to it. And on the top of the box, on the top of each line, if you hear a bit, one dot, you put a check in the first box. If you hear two dits, you put it in the second box. If you hear three dits, you put it in the third box, and if you hear fourth it, you put it in the fourth box. In other words, they are actually sending just dots, you know. They're sending dit, E, dit, I, S, dit, and H, dit. But they didn't ever knew that. Then what they did is they gave you some practice, very slow. They'd go dit, and they pause for like 10 seconds, and of course anybody could go ahead and, one dip, he said one, box one, he docked it in, go down to the next one, line number two, and they go, dip, all right, I put it in that, and so on. Then they start speeding it up, and speeding it up, so they got to 10 words a minute. Actually, in the military, I taught CW for some of the more advanced ones, up to 15 words a minute, but most of it was like no more than like 10 or 12 words a minute, Dick, over.
Interesting. Joe, you had a question or a comment? Go right ahead.
Yeah, the question is on a completely different subject if you got a moment. It's not about CW at all.
While Mel is studying his mail and deciding whose letter he's going to read, why don't you fire away with your question, Joe?
This past week, I guess when Obama was in Jersey, I don't know if it was the day he was actually in New Jersey, or maybe the following day, I don't recall exactly when it was, there was a tremendous amount of radar on the band, and it was happening up around, say, the higher end of the band, around 448 to 449, and I also heard it switch frequencies where it went much lower than the band, around 433 to 435. My question was, which I've never heard with the radar before, the particular pitch that I heard the radar signal emit is somewhere around 300 hertz. I have measured that in the AM decode on a service monitor, about like 301 hertz. But this particular radar I was listening to was instantaneously, was changing the pitch. It would run at one pitch, like it seemed to be about 300 hertz or so, and it would run that for about 15, 20, 30, 40 seconds. And all of a sudden, in the middle, with the same transmission, you hit a pitch maybe going out about 200 hertz approximately, so 180, 200 hertz. Why is that?
And that's changing the rep rate. And as you go to low, medium, and high rep rate on a airborne Doppler radar, I'm not saying it was, but it might be, on an airborne Doppler radar, you've got at least three modes of operation where the rep rate changes in order to solve the problem of ambiguity in range or ambiguity in velocity. When you choose a particular rep rate on a radar, and if it's a radar that can look for phase shift or frequency shift due to Doppler because the target is moving, at a particular rep rate, there are certain blind speeds. If from pulse number one to pulse number two, the signal due to Doppler shift is shifting some multiple of 360 degrees, you end up with a velocity ambiguity. And also, if your rep rate is, you get around that problem by using a very high rep rate. But a very high rep rate now has a range ambiguity, where beyond a certain range, the signal wraps around and looks like it's at a low range when it's really at a large range. So by changing rep rate, you resolve the problem of blind spots in velocity or blind spots in range. You would like to think that that's a nice, smart engineering development by some radar designer. Mother Nature has been doing it for thousands or millions of years. Bats do it all the time. When you've got 10,000 bats coming out of that cave simultaneously at nighttime, and they're all beeping away with their acoustic radars, they're doing all kinds of fancy rip rate change and chirp rate changes in order to recognize the characteristic of their particular echoes versus all the other 10,000 birds, 10,000 bats. So that's what I think was going on. And maybe that radar was turned on to give extra protection during the time that the president was in the area. That's a guess. Back to you, Joe. Give a little bit of light. You have to teach him RAW.
Okay, and why would they also change frequency bands instantaneously too? Because I said I heard it happen on the high end of the amateur band, and I heard it go to shift much lower because it happened to be going across one of my link frequencies, which is around between 433 to 435. When it went in that part of the band, it would be in one for, say, like about 5 or 6, maybe 10 minutes at a clip, and it's just, you'd hear it instantly go off and it would just come out elsewhere.
It sounds to me like you're listening to what used to be called an agile radar. The word radar is changing an awful lot as time goes on. And there used to be this battle going on between the radar designer and the countermeasures jamming designer. The countermeasures engineer and the electronic countermeasures engineer and the radar designer. And right now the radar designer is winning the war. Because if he's smart enough, he can design a radar that can shift in frequency, shift in rep rate, shift in chirp magnitude, shift in chirp rate. There's all kinds of parameters you can be changing on a radar. And as you make the radar more and more agile, it becomes more and more difficult or impossible to jam it. And each frequency region where you operate a radar has certain advantages as far as the way propagation occurs, the way echoes off the aircraft occurs. If you had the ability to switch the frequency of your radar so that you can choose a frequency where your particular target happens to go through a peak in its echo magnitude, a peak in its radar cross-section, I think you can see the advantage of that. So I'm making a guess. You're listening to one of the more modern agile radars. Over to you, Joe.
Okay, last question. Do you think, because you probably have a pretty good idea what this is, do you think this stuff is airborne, high altitude, extremely high power level, emitting a type of equipment?
There's a lot of advantage in the radar being airborne if you want to see over the horizon, long distances. If you go to a low enough frequency, you can build a ground-based radar that can send signals over the horizon. There have been radars in the past which were ground-based, very high in their sophistication of back-end processing. You and I would nowadays call it digital signal processing techniques, where that whole package together is called radio science, and there's a whole series of journals you can buy or read and a good technical library on the subject of radio science. You could, in theory, set up a radar in the state of Maine that looks over the North Pole of the United States, and it essentially measures every vehicle that's moving in Europe. It is possible to do that, and I think it's been done. I'm talking about ground-based vehicles as well as airborne vehicles. It is possible to look at all of those moving vehicles and in many cases figuring out where they started from, where they're going to, and maybe what they're doing. So radar with the right kind of hardware and the right kind of software can do an awful lot of magic. Bats have been doing it for years. There's ample evidence that a bat gets an acoustic echo off of his targets, which constitutes a kind of three-dimensional picture where he can tell a soft object from a hard object, a living object from a non-living object, and by the characteristics of the echo, he can recognize whether or not it's his favorite kind of insect. He flies toward it, scoops it up with his wing, puts it into his mouth, and chomps down on it. Now back to you, Joe. KQRIW.
Okay, well, being that you probably worked on something like this, that's why I figured I'd ask the question. But this stuff had a repetition rate of about approximately 9.5 seconds. You see it peak. So I was watching this on the my R7000, and it would give me readings of about 25 over S9 approximately on a monitor antenna.
Yeah, what was that period of time again that you said, and what changed in what period of time, Joe? Go ahead.
The peak amplitude seemed to have a repetition rate, like, say, if you can imagine that this thing was a revolving antenna, approximately 9.5 seconds. It wasn't quite 10 seconds. It was maybe leaving less than it. I'd say about 8.5 to 9 seconds in a rotation. It was definitely under 10 seconds. And I was getting a peak signal on the R7000 on both frequency bands of approximately 25 dB over S9. Because I could put the thing in AM and I could hear the thing when the thing went flying. You could see, watch the S meter deflection go up.
Yeah, as that main lobe scanned by you, you probably heard this burp sound. And I think you're saying it happened every 9 or 10 seconds. Surveillance radar, or ground control radar, I guess it is, ASR 7 or ASR 8 that's mounted at Islip Airport, I think that one sweeps once every 12 seconds. So it certainly sounds like a kind of antenna with a antenna that swept 360 degrees, possibly, at that particular rate. And so an airborne radar is a good guess. I guess there's a person I could talk to. I've got a guess as to what kind of an aircraft it might have been. And I'll see if I can do any confirmation on that one. I'll back you for any other comments, Joe.
No, the whole thing is basically just a curiosity kind of thing, because, I mean, I've heard this radar on the amateur band and the UHF for 25 years now, and it comes and goes, and nobody seems to know exactly who it is, where it's coming from, and it just popped, this stuff just popped in out of nowhere. And the odd thing was, it was going on across my repeater output frequency and one of my link frequencies. That's why I haven't been paying it, a little closer attention to it. And it just seemed to almost coincide with the president's visit to New York, New Jersey a couple of days ago. Back to you.
Yeah, each time we've got dignitaries in the New York area, we hear some funny things on our frequencies. When there was that great big meeting a couple of weeks ago at the UN, we heard all kinds of funny frequencies. And I think we've already had partial confirmation of some of our speculations on that one. Mel, what email do you think is interesting tonight? K2KEY, with a little delay, K2RIW.
Okay, I got a very interesting one here. This comes from a fellow by the name of Bob Gross. He says, "You will not recognize my name, but my grandfather was Jerry Gross. Jerry Gross was better known as Jerry's Place, and he had a place where he worked in New York called Gross Radio on 51 Vesey Street, which was the heart of Radio Row, and it was a popular hangout for enthusiastic amateurs. For instance, I got a piece of advertisement here that he would advertise in the magazine. I will sell you a 6-foot relay rack complete with panels, meters. It has in it 2 866 tubes. It has a kilowatt plate transformer with the filter condensers and all, and it sold for $16.95, Dick, over."
What year do you think that was being sold, Mel? And was that one of the places you visited when you used to visit Radio Row?
It's 1947, this is. Now, if you wanted to buy the parts separate, he listed it that he broke up a certain number of these racks because their condition was not the best. he'd sell you 866 rectifier tubes with the sockets, 99 cents a piece. He'd sell you the kilowatt plate transformer for $11, and in parentheses, that's what its weight in copper is, and what it's worth in copper scrap. And the meters were $1.35 a piece, Dick. Over.
Beautiful sounding prices. However, what do you believe was a good salary in dollars per week in those days, Mel?
I guess 1947. I guess what? Maybe we're up to what? $40 a week? $50 a week? $47? I don't know. Somewhere in that neighborhood. I said right after World War II, I think things did go up after World War II. So I guess it was in not too bad, really. He also has here an advertisement that says he also was a distributor for a low-cost transmitter for beginners, and he called it the 30-watt, the amateur radio 30-watt transmitter, which was a kit. It covered 80, 40, and 20 meters. Complete, $13.95, Dick, over.
And if you made $40 a week and you spent $13 on that thing, you're spending one-third of your salary for that week. Put in that frame, it sounds a little more expensive. But a lot of people forget about the fact that the inflation over all of those years is awfully significant. So $13 then, for all we know, might be worth $700 today, some crazy number like that. Awful good-sounding prices, but probably a gallon of gas in those days was, what, 13 cents or something like that? Again, very hard to compare. Do you believe you visited any of the stores on that particular street when you visited Radio Row, Mel? Go ahead.
Of course, I knew them all. And in fact, he goes on to say, he says, I also have fond memories of my uncle, of my grandfather, telling me about my uncle, who also worked there in a place called Leeds Wholesale Radio. And I also had a cousin that worked in another one called Bland. It was known as Bland the Radio Man. Yeah, I remember them. Oh boy, Bland the Radio Man had a place, Dick, that the only way I could describe it was how he ever found anything in that place. It was just shoved in. Stuff laying all over. I remember that place. It was a total mess. Just piled in there. I don't know how you could get anything, find anything. You'd walk through an aisle that were like 2 foot wide, and it was just stacked up, just thrown in pieces of everything. I don't know. I guess you just have to walk and say, hey, I want that. He'd have to actually climb on this mountain of junk sometime, on a mountain of radio equipment and parts, and dig something out for you. It was unbelievable. Bland the Radio Man, over.
Yeah, there are librarians like that, too, and people who run a bookstore where when you go in, they know where every single book is located. Some people are very good at storing things like that in their brain. I wish my stuff was arranged anywhere near like that so I could find things. You've heard the story so often of me being in a hardware store in some far-off town, and I say, gee, that looks like a fun thing to have. And I bring it home and find that I've already got a couple of them. Didn't remember that I bought them in the past. Or there were times when I spend some significant amount of time looking for something I know I've got, and the quickest way I can find it is to go buy another one. Back to you, Mel.
Roger. Okay. Yeah, so for that was you'd have to have seen it. This was, I talk to you as saying that no matter how much you stretch your imagination, you would never seen anything like this. I guess to clean that place out, they must have had to rip the roof off of it and just clean out with a steam shovel, because I've never seen, to this day, even the window, everything was just packed in there with just no rhyme or reason, just thrown in there. I mean, it was Bland the Radio Man. When he mentioned that, I started to laugh, because that was really most unusual place that you could ever have seen. Okay, I just thought I'd bring that up. Anybody want to ask questions about it? about my misguided youth. Over. Okay, there's another one. Let's see. You're always talking about open line, balanced feeders, how good it is. Can you use it on 2 meters, and how? Hey, that's a good question. Using open wire feeders instead of coax on 2 meters, Dick. How would you go about it? Over.
Oh, absolutely. I remember the horror I felt at first, and I was completely wrong on this one. When the A1FFO, which became K1FO, Steve Polishin, first set up his open wire feeders on a phased array of Yagis on 432 megacycles. He made open wire feeders on 432 megacycles out of what looked like a 14-gauge or 16-gauge wire. And I think the spacing between the wires was in the vicinity of half an inch. As long as the wavelengths between the two wires of an open wire system is a small enough fraction of the wavelength that you're operating at, even though your eye says that's a completely open structure, to that radio wave, that is a very closed, reasonably well shielded transmission line. It's hard to believe. So, on 2 meters, easy. Some of the ladder line you can buy will have a close enough spacing. It's obvious that Television 300 ohm twin lead, which was a very popular transmission line up until, let's say 1990 or so, it was open wire line. There happened to be a chunk of plastic there between the two wires. But even at UHF frequencies, people were using it all the way up to 800 megacycles. See, 470 to 890. In the early days, UHF television went to 890 megacycles, and that was being fed with 300 ohm twin lead. So making sure you don't have great big lumps of capacitance in the spacers, and making sure that the lines are the right distance in wavelengths. In theory, you can use open wire line, probably at millimeter wave frequencies. I'll admit the spacing between the lines is something you're going to look at under a microscope, but again, it's just the old rule. We think that something magic about radio and something entirely different occurs at, say, for instance, light frequencies or infrared frequencies. It's all the exact same electromagnetic spectrum. If you scale everything you're doing proportional to wavelength, you will get the exact same performance. That allows you to take somebody's Yagi on 80 meters and scale it to 1296 if you want to do that, and you will get the same performance. K2KUI with some delay, K2LIW.
Okay, I guess you can come up with some kind of a tuner to change from your balanced feeders to your unbalanced to connect to the rig. I'm sure that there must be a simple type of ATU that you could put together for that, Dick. That would work fairly well, I would guess. Would just need maybe a couple of coils, a couple of tuning capacitors, correct? Over.
Yes, Mel, I've done it that way on printed circuit cards. An unbalanced to balanced adapter, where simultaneously you're going from balanced to unbalanced, as well as changing the impedance. You can do that with two inductors and two capacitors. That's one approach. If your frequency region is not a great big percentage, a half-wave coax balance does a beautiful job of converting 50-ohm coax into 200-ohm twin lead. Half-wave coax balance does that very nicely. Fairly simple structure to build. So, if you go to an article by Ruthroff, R-U-T-H-R-O-F-F, a classic article in microwave theory and techniques, I think it was around 1968, and the article was labeled Some Balancing Structures. Very simple sounding title by Ruthruff. I think he has in that article something like 15 different ways of going between unbalanced and balanced. There's only about 15 major ways of doing it, Mel. K2KEY. K2RIW.
Yes, I'm very familiar with Ruff and his work. He did the mathematical work. Yes, okay. So I guess you've been there and have worked with balanced lines at 144 and at 70 centimeters, and it worked out quite well. Okay, because, you know, you never see any mention of it in any of the QSTs or anything. Everything has always been, of course, more or less like coax and things like you say. We use flat 300-ohm ribbon wire for television, which, as you said, went up way up into the what we were known as the UHF frequencies. It's doable, I guess, on 2 meters. Maybe would it be practical, 300-ohm twin lead as we knew it in the TV days, say for a fairly long run on 2 meters? Over.
I ran 300-ohm twin lead on 432, 130 foot of it, in the 1970 time frame. Worked rather well. Modern-day hardline coax is lower in loss and has less weather detriment. Now, the problem with twin lead is that if it doesn't have a great big chunk of foam between the two wires, has a great big blob in cross-section, then water getting on the twin lead makes it behave differently on a rainy day versus a dry day. And particularly as the rubber between the two leads dries out and gets cracks and fills up with water on a rainy day, your transmission line changes a whole lot. But in its day, it gave you the best bang for the dollar. We didn't have fancy foam-filled coax cables of low loss in those days. So twin lead was very popular for television aerials, not only because it was inexpensive, but because it was about the lowest loss stuff you could get in that day, without getting really heroic and using something like a half-inch diameter heliax, which I'm not even sure existed back in the days when television was first becoming popular, 1947, 1948 time frame. Television took off like a rocket in those days, and everybody's antenna was 300-ohm twin lead. And there was also a small amount of 200-ohm so-called transmitting twin lead made by ITT. So, there's quite a history of twin lead, but you've got to obey all the rules. You can't lay it against a piece of metal. You got to keep the water away from it. You got to keep the spacing between it small and wavelengths. Coax cable solves many of those problems better today. You're much better off feeding your television aerial and most of your ham antennas with the right design of coax cable, the right chosen brand. So twin lead is becoming very unpopular, except in some exotic locations these days. Back to you, Mel. K2RIW. Be some delay.
Okay. Yeah, only thing is, if you remember, yeah, back in the 40s, coax was still like a new product because it was only really developed during World War II. And when Dumont started producing television sets, that company did not use a balanced feeder system. He insisted that his television antenna and the feed line was coax. He had a fitting on the back that was one of the early fittings for coaxial cable. It it took a kind of connector that he have on the back there. I'm trying to picture the Dumont connector for coax. But it wasn't a terminal. It was an actual like they had on all the TV sets, of course, that took the 300-ohm balanced feeder cable had two terminals in the back that 300 ohms, whereas Dumont had the coax. And there was a lot of people, I remember, television guys, that said, oh, that's a special antenna installation. You had to get a two-line antenna. They did not know how to work with coax, so I doubt very much if there was really much in the way of coax and exotic coax like anything like hardline around in those days, Dick, over.
I agree with you. Hardline is a much later development. And once coax started catching on for cable TV systems, all of a sudden we started seeing something called the F connector. And a connector that uses the center conductor of the cable as the center conductor for the connector. And that was a pretty wild idea the first time I saw that. I'm trying to remember when I first saw an F connector. Probably in the middle 70s or so. I think that's roughly when I first saw an F connector. If you're in the United Kingdom and you look for the kind of connector you've got on the end of your coaxial cable, an inexpensive connector they use over there is not an F connector. In many cases, it's this thing that comes apart in two or three pieces that you assemble around the end of the cable. It's called a Billings-Lee connector. And I went into a hardware store in the United Kingdom, I guess that was 1979, I think it was. And I think I paid something like 30 pence to buy this Billings-Lee connector, which is very popular on their television sets. And UHF television was much more popular in Europe than it was in the United States. But boy, has that changed. We've almost abandoned VHF television. We've gone almost always completely over to UHF. Europe's been there for a long time. Now back to you, Mel, KQRIW.
Roger. Yeah, I just remembered what the connector looked like for coax back in those days of 40s on the television set. You know the connector that's used on your car radio, that you plug in the antenna on the car radio? I think they refer to it as that called the Motorola connector, Dick. Over.
I've heard it called that. And also the RCA phono plug. It's hard to believe that that connector was used on a lot of Motorola radios, transmitters. It's hard to believe that connector has enough quality, but it does. Now back to you, Mel.
Roger. Yeah, well, of course you had to solder that connector on to the coax, but I remember now, I just pictured, I remember that quarter-inch opening, and I remember that it was the same plug that basically used on car radios. I think maybe still used on car radios to connect. I don't know what the modern car radio looks like, but I know from, it hung on for many years that as the standard connector used on car radios. And I think, was it called a Motorola connector? I'm not sure, over.
An awful lot of people called it that. So maybe that was the official name for it, Mel.
Okay. I was just wondering because, you know, I was always curious what was the true name was for it. I guess, okay, like you referred to an RCA connector. I guess you could call that Motorola connector. All right, here's another one. I'm telling you, I get some good ones here. I bought a antenna tuner, and it's marked on it, Gonset. Gonset. Here, listen to this one, the Jick Dick. Gonset strip line unbalanced antenna tuner for 144 megahertz. When I opened it up, I know something is burned. There's a plastic board in there. It looks like something burned. Can you tell me what was in there that burned? It's got one variable condenser built into the case. No, two variable. I see. Oh, I see how he is. He has one variable on one end and one variable on the other and two connectors on it and something in between there. What was in there that burnt out? On a, well, he gave it away, strip line type unbalanced tuner made by Gonset. Over.
I'm always kind of amazed that antenna tuners are now so popular on 80 through 10 meters and they're almost completely absent everywhere else. Obviously, UHF antennas, VHF and UHF antennas, are not always exactly 50 ohms. So an antenna tuner would work there. And I'm just kind of amazed that it never became popular. And some performance improvements would definitely take place if there were more antenna tuners. Another thing that was kind of amazing in the beginning is that the first antenna tuners really were the Pi network that you and I are familiar with C1 being the loading capacitor and C2 being the tuning gear. I got it backwards. C1 is the tuning capacitor, C2 is the loading capacitor. And that was a manual antenna tuner. And eventually that became non-existent. We started buying radios without any kind of tuning at all, no tune radios. We thought that was an advantage. Sounds like an advantage, a more compact box. But now you've got a very strict requirement for the standing wave ratio maximum of the thing you connect to that box. And along came the antenna tuner. So now the antenna tuner is back in again. It's the Pi network in most cases. And for a long time, they weren't automatic. We thought it was going to be very exotic, where the thing called antenna tuner had the ability to measure not only the amount of reflected power from the antenna, but the phase angle of the reflected power. Once you know the reflected power amplitude and phase, you've got all the raw data you need to figure out how to set C1 and C2 of a Pi network, if that's what you want to use. So all of a sudden, we've got in automatic antenna tuners. But I haven't seen antenna tuners per se on VHF frequencies, and automatic antenna tuners, my goodness, that's somebody's pipe dream. I think it's about time. Measuring phase at RF frequencies, like the very first network analyzers when they came out. Let me drop. To measure RF phase at frequencies like 30, 100, 500, 1,000 megacycles, all back in the late 60s and early 70s, that sounded very exotic. You can now buy a French-made network analyzer that measures amplitude and phase of reflected signal and gives you beautiful Smith chart plots up to 300 gigahertz. We used to think measuring phase was so exotic and so difficult. Now, a small number of companies do it at 300 gigs. Just a matter of miniaturizing the technology. The first time we saw a pocket transistor radio, and you looked inside and you found out how small they made the variable capacitor. I don't know about you, Mel, but my first impression, and I was wrong, was, gee, it is so small and chintzy looking, it can't be high in quality. That must be a really yucky radio. I'm holding in front of me right now a printed circuit board. It's got a whole lot of 0201 surface mount components that I can just barely see the components without a magnifying glass. And this printed circuit board contains something like four or five individual radios, complete transmitters and receivers. I'm looking at a transmitting receiving duplexing filter that is approximately an eighth of an inch square. You and I have seen duplexing filters that go into the repeaters that we use on 2 meters and 432, and they fill up a number of cubic feet. I'm looking at a duplexing filter made out of barium tetratitanate, a material that's got a dielectric constant of 100, and this six-pole tuner, six-cavity tuner, is in one package that's a little more than an eighth of an inch wide and a little bit less than a quarter of an inch long, and a second package that's two-thirds of that size. These two little packages, each one about 3/32 of an inch high, mounted on a PC board as part of the transmitter-receiving function of these multiple radios that are on this printed circuit card that's an inch and a half wide and 5 inches long. We've come a long way. I've recently been studying a particular radio. I wanted to know what all was in there. And I found out the particular radio that I was studying had seven individual transmitters and receivers on a printed circuit board close to the size that I just described to you. And the printed circuit board has 15 layers to it. Some of the leads out of some of these tiny little integrated circuits, like an RF output of one of the transmitters, goes into a plated through hole. It goes down about five layers in the board, joins a piece of microstrip or strip line, goes some number of inches off to one side, comes out the other side of the board, where the other side of the board is coming out from 10 layers down. You try to trace a circuit like that, modern day circuit, with miniature tools and a microscope, and it ain't easy. And you know what Moore's Law is. Moore's Law, let me drop. Mr. Moore, in something like 1968, I think it was, when he was founding Intel Corporation, made a prediction that every 18 months approximately, you would double the number of transistors on an integrated circuit. Double every 18 months, starting in 1968. And people said, he might be right for a couple of years, but he's going to run out of steam. Here we are 40 years later, 41 years later, he has met that prediction essentially every one of those years. Each time we think we've gone to the limit where we're getting down to the microscopic scale and the radio can't possibly get any smaller, somebody comes along 18 months later and makes one almost half the size. It makes you and I feel kind of ancient when you look at, you take a modern day stereo zoom microscope and you look at a modern day radio printed circuit board, and it makes me a little bit humble. I don't know about you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, I've had some adventure in the last few weeks. I rescued a Yaesu FP817 from the garbage pail. This is a QRP rig that is single size in, CW, the whole works, everything, and goes from 160 through 70 centimeters, all modes. And it is a cute little thing, weighs only a few pounds. You have an internal battery pack you can put into it and all. And it was hooked to a wrong power supply, defective power supply, and burned out. And I rescued it. It was going to the garbage pail because it was prohibitive price to repair it. And when I got involved in there, Dick, boy, I said to myself, I got deeper and deeper in water. And you talk about troubleshooting it with magnifying glasses and eye loops and on and on and on, and taking out those components and then finding these components and putting them in. Oh boy, I had an adventure with this thing till I got it working, and I had a lot of different problems in it. You can well imagine in 1 second how you could blow a thing like this out. All right, anyhow, do you know what a Gonset? Back to the question. Gonset, strip line unbalanced tuner was. I have any idea, over.
I think I don't. I don't think I've ever seen one, Mel. What year do you believe this thing was manufactured?
Was for Gonset. It was for the Gonset communicator. Do you remember Gonset 2-meter communicators, over?
Oh, yes. I've seen a lot of those. And a good number of them used to have a great big red Charlie Delta on it because they were part of the Civil Defense Corporation. Quite a few of them had a white box with red lettering. Go ahead.
They actually pioneered the 2-meter, you know, that was a 2-meter AM rig that, I don't know, what was the cable? Maybe about 10 watts? Gee, I don't remember what it was, around 10 watts. And had the receiver and a transmitter. Remember, it was crystal controlled, and it used crystals. I remember doubles and triples and quadruples. I think they were 8 megahertz crystals. And it doubled and tripled and quadrupled or whatever it is, so it got to 2 meters. But you plugged in, you know, single crystals, had that big, you know, knob on it, that the transmit-receive knob, and, you know, the dial, you tuned it, had the eye, the magic eye on it, over, for tuning, over.
Did the early versions of those, Mel, have a super regen receiver? And they didn't have a squelch control, as I remember. They were kind of noisy. Didn't everybody call it a rush box because you always heard that noise coming out of it? Go ahead.
They referred to it as the Goonie Box. The Goonie Box for some something, I guess Gonsett, Cooney. And yeah, it had that. Well, remember, it was only an AM transmitted. Not CW, not sideband, none of that was known. It was strictly for 2 meter AM, Dick, if you remember. And you tuned it. You remember you closed the eye. You had a bunch of variable capacitor, you know, knobs on it that you manipulated, I could say, because you had it just first, I guess, the doubler, then there was a tripler, and I don't remember how the heck that damn thing got up to 2 meters, starting, I think, at 8 megahertz, over.
Yeah, 8 times, let me think now. Well, 144 maybe divided by 8, you'll find it real fast, but, what did they do to get rid of that rush box sign? I had the impression that the early Gonsett communicators had a super regen front end or something like it, and boy, they must have had a 10 dB noise figure. They weren't super sensitive. It was a lot of radio for a very small number of tubes in a box, and it did work, and it got you up on VHF frequencies, and along come the Clegg Zeus and Clegg Interceptor. I bet you've seen some of those in the early 60s. And in its day, boy, was that a massive piece of electronics. Had a real VFO, free-running VFO, on 144 megacycles. And let me think now. I think that was an AM rig. I don't think it was sideband. It took some number of years beyond the early 60s before we started really using frequency synthesizers. Our early FM rigs were all crystal controlled, and along came the GLB and the GLB synthesizer, which allowed you to have the equivalent of a zillion 8 megacycle crystals. You could plug it into one of these rigs, and then the first rig that came out with crystals with a synthesizer built into the rig. Wasn't it called a KL something or other? I'm trying to remember that model number. You probably know the one I'm talking about. How back to you, Mel.
Roger. But the Gonsett we were talking about originally, the Gonsett communicator, because that's what he's asking here. This is the tuner. There was a tuner for it. And it was called a strip line unbound tuner for 144 megahertz. And he said something's burned in there. And I know when he said strip line, I know what was burned in there. Basically, they had a strip of copper that was on a piece of board, a little thin piece of like copper. What was that? It looked like aluminum foil. And, of course, if you put more than maybe a few watts into the thing, you would burn out that strip. So I think the strip, how long was the strip? Maybe about, well, let's see, 144 megs. I think it was about 9 inches long, that strip of copper, something like that. Maybe a half inch wide. That's what is burned out, and that's what he's asking about, what burned out in the tuner that he bought, this Gonsett tuner. Now, the Gonsett communicator got a lot of people onto 2 meters in those days, because it was a full rig. It was an AM transmitter, and it made 2 meters, 2 meters, because, you know, up to that, there was only experimental after World War II people experiment. Then the 50s came along. Gonsett came out with the communicator. And what was also nice about the communicator, it had that dual power supply that you could use either 110 volts or you could use 6 volts DC. It was meant for those cars of those days, which were all 6 volts battery cars, you know, batteries in a car, a good electrical system in a car with 6 volts. So you could use 6 volts DC just by changing, if you remember, they had interchangeable Jones plugs. One was for 110 volts AC, the other one was for the DC, Dick, over.
WB2HWW18 was the mobile client.
This is the WQVL repeater.
Thank you, Alan. That makes a lot of sense. 18 was the multiplier.
Next time,
and,
complete.
When it comes... When it comes to the right multiplier to get you up to 241.43 gigahertz. Yeah, 241. 241 gigahertz. I think it's 168th multiple of 2 meters. Can you imagine taking a 2-meter signal and multiplying it something like 168 times? So multipliers are a good way to go. KDK was the name.